Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, thinkers, and today, rogue revelers, recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. This is our last episode for 2014. We started the year with Julia Serrano, Sonia Sotomayor, and Majora Carter, hit our stride with Sandra Singh Lowe and Trans Pride Seattle, and finished out with Cornel West, Clay Jenkinson, and Jeff Robinson. If you're new to the series, you can check out the archives at kuow.org/speakersforum, or subscribe via your favorite aggregator. Now to the matter at hand. Thanks to Town Hall Seattle and Short Stories Live, the timing worked out well to present this Yuletide episode of Speakers Forum. It features stories by E.B. White, John Updike, Ken Kesey, Vladimir Nabokov, and a spoof of Clement Clark Moore's A Visit from St. Nicholas. Readers include Paul Dorpat, Gene Sherrod, Randy Hoffmeyer, Marianne Owen, and David Scovar. And you'll hear musical interludes from the Seattle band Pineola. A Rogue's Christmas was presented on December 14, 2014, by Town Hall Seattle as part of their Arts and Culture series, and by Short Stories Live. Sponsors included City Arts and the Thurston Charitable Foundation. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for this recording.
Welcome to another Rogue's Christmas. This is our eighth year of roguish holiday cheer. And we have a few people to acknowledge. We're part of the ACT Town Hall ongoing collaboration, Short Stories Live, which has been curated by Kurt Beatty for all of these years and beyond. And Kurt is one of our favorite rogues, along with Ware Harmon, who's the executive director here at Town Hall, and Stesha Brandon and all of her immensely talented staff here. So a shout out to all of them before we get started. And let's go. So this afternoon, we have a marvelous selection, a varied selection of stories and songs and prepared for you. But I'd like to begin with a little bit from John Updike. Updike once stated that his responsibility as a writer was to face the fact that ordinary lives are what most people live most of the time, and that as a novelist, he had to make an interesting narrative out of the ordinary and the banal. So his 12 Terrors of Christmas offer us a glimpse into a little bit of that method. So, can you press the first button and let's get terrified here. Okay, that's enough. The 12 Terrors of Christmas by John Updike. 1. Santa the Man. Loose-fitting nylon beard, fake optical twinkle, cheap red suit, funny rummy smell when you sit on his lap. If he's such a big shot, why is he drawing unemployment for 11 months of the year? Something scary and off-key about him, like one of those Stephen King clowns. 2. Santa the Concept. Why would anybody halfway normal want to live at the North Pole on a bunch of shifting ice floes? Or stay up all night flying around the sky distributing presents to children of doubtful deservingness? There's a point where altruism becomes sick, or else a sinister cover for an international scam. A man of no plausible address, with no apparent source for his considerable wealth, comes down the chimney after midnight while decent law-abiding citizens are snug in their beds. Is this not at the least a cause for alarm? 3. Santa's Helpers. Again, what is really going on? Why do these purported elves submit to sweatshop conditions in what must be one of the gloomiest climates in the world unless they're getting something out of it at our expense? Underclass masochism one day, bloody rebellion the next. The rat-tat-tat of tiny hammers may just be the beginning. O Tannenbaum, suppose it topples over under its weight of explosive baubles. Suppose it harbors wood borers that will migrate to the furniture. There's something ghastly about a tree. Its look of many-limbed paralysis, its shaggy and consciousness aplomb, encountered in the open, let alone in the living room. At night, you can hear it rustling and drinking water out of the bucket. 5. Tiny reindeer. Hooves that cut through roof shingles like linoleum knives. Antlers like 100 dead branches. Unstable flight patterns suggesting dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly. Fur possibly laden with disease-bearing ticks. 6. Electrocution. It's not just the frayed strings of light anymore, or the corroded transformer of the plucky little Lionel. It's all those battery packs, those electronic games, those built-in dictionaries, those robots a-sizzle with artificial intelligence. Even the tinsel tingles. 7. The carols. They boom and chime from the vaulted ceilings of supermarkets and discount stores, and yet the spirits keep sinking. Have our hearts grown so terribly heavy since childhood? What has happened to us? Why don't they ever play our favorites? What were our favorites? Tum da dum tum, angels on high, something something sky. 8. The specials. Was Charlie Brown's voice always so plaintive and grating? Did Bing Crosby always have that little pot belly and walk with his toes out? Wasn't that Danny Kaye, Fred Astaire, Jimmy Stewart, Grinch a card? Is Vera Ellen still alive? Isn't there something else on, like wrestling or Easter parade? 9. Fear of not giving enough leads to dizziness in shopping malls, foot fractures on speeded-up escalators, thumb and wrist sprain in the course of package manipulation, eye and facial injuries in carton-crowded buses, and fluttering sensations of disorientation and imminent impoverishment. 10. Fear of not receiving enough leads to anxious scanning of UPS deliveries into identity crisis on Christmas morning as the piles of rumpled wrapping paper and emptied boxes mount higher and higher around every chair but your own. 3 dull neckties and a pair of flannel-lined work gloves. Is that really how they see you? 11. Fear of returns. The embarrassments. The unseemly haggling. The lost receipts. The allegations of damaged goods. The humiliating descent into mercantilism's boiler room. And 12. The dark. How early it comes now. How creepy and green in the gills everybody looks. Scrabbling along in drab winter wraps by the phosphorus light of department store windows full of styrofoam snow, mock-ups of a factitious 1890, and beige mannequins posed with a false jauntiness in plaid bathrobes. Is this hell or just an upturn in consumer confidence? And now we have a kind of a tradition at Rose Christmas. Paul Dorpat is going to teach us a song from his childhood. Paul, can you come on up? And I think we actually have a clip of Paul and his brothers from 7 or 8 years ago. And so you can get a sense of how this song goes. Should we play the clip, Paul?
Yeah, certainly, Gene. I think that would help us all. For instance, it helped me get the pitch.
All right. That's good. All Noel, right. Can you hit the button there?
Thank you so much, Dan, Marvin, and you. And,
I can't sing.
We're all going to sing it together.
Okay, here we go, Dave.
It's going to be a long winter. What will the poor birdies do then, the poor tins? They'll fly to the south, mid to the worm in their mouth, and then put their heads under their wings, the poor tins.
May I say something about the history of it? Let me tell you, the first time I heard this song was at the Lutheran Conference for the Ministers in Bend, Oregon. And this wasn't all the Lutherans of the Northwest. It was just the Missouri Synod. It was a very select group. And they sang this together. That's where I first heard it. But then I also learned that it has a much older tradition in the Midwest, that my great-great-grandfather, Erasmus Dorpat, used to sing it, and he taught it to us. And that I've mentioned in an earlier one of these Sunday events about Erasmus. He was a pastor, an itinerant pastor. He was at Lake Winnebago in Minnesota, and then he was so popular that he was asked to take over a parish on an unnamed lake nearby, which in his appeal, they named after one of his expressions, "Oh, woe be gone." They named it Lake Woe Be Gone. And as some of you know that same lake from a certain radio show, and the Dorpats don't complain about that. We think it's fine that that lake's name be used in that radio show, although sometimes the stories about it are a bit extreme or exaggerated. So that's how this song came along, and some of you sung it before here, haven't you? Have you been here before and sung this? Raise your hand if you have. Now shake it if you like it, if you had a good time. Shake your hand. That's good. All right, we're going to sing it again, and again we'll have the lyrics up here. I'm going to go back and stand and get the pitch correctly. Here we go. And I think Gene will be the director, huh?
Yeah, get up there and stand on the mic.
All right.
There you go.
Gonna give it to me again.
It's gonna be long.
Oh, Christ, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's gonna be a long. Is that it? It's gonna be a long.
You got it.
It's gonna be a long. You start it out.
It's gonna be a long.
Long.
Winter.
Winter. And what will the poor birdies do then, the poor tings? They'll fly to the south, with a worm in their mouth, and they'll put their heads under their wings, the poor tings.
Are you following along okay?
All right. Okay. Number two is spring.
It's going to be a long spring. And what will the poor birdies do then, the poor things? They'll fly to the sky with a worm in their mouth. And they'll put their heads under their wings, the poor things. It's going to be a long summer. And what will the poor birdies do then, the poor things? They'll fly to the pool, just to keep themselves cool, and they'll put their heads under their wings, the poor things.
Okay, I have a question before we sing the last verse. Why the faux Scandinavian accent?
Why is this relevant to Christmas?
You,
Good comeback, Paul.
That's yeah, that's true. I'm speechless. I don't know. I guess this could be sung any time of the year.
Pretty much covers them all, yeah.
So
that's
know.
It. You had a good answer, Gene.
Yeah, well,
that's a good answer.
Okay. So really, really, it's the identical. There's no reason why it's a Scandinavian accent. Is it Missouri Synod? We're mostly
no
Scandinavian.
Missouri Synod is largely German. Not too popular a few times in the 20th century, but no, I don't know why we do the Scandinavian accent because there was most of Scandies in Minnesota, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
You want to try it with a German accent?
I wouldn't know how. You know, okay. I know nothing of Germans, really.
Stick with what you know.
Okay. Where are we now? We're in autumn. We're in the autumn. Here we go.
It's going to be a long haul. And what will the poor birdies do? Then the poor things, they'll fly to the barn just to keep themselves warm. And they'll put the heads under their wings, the poor things.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Good job, Paul.
I don't know.
So Paul's going to come right back and read something for us right now by E.B. White, who was born in 1899 and is familiar to, I'm sure, all of you for having written Charlotte's Web and Trumpet of the Swan and, Strunk and White, Elements of Style. And also, a little local tidbit, E.B. White was fired by the Seattle Times after working there for 7 or 8 months. In 1923, they said, that's it. We don't want him anymore. And 2 years later, he was writing for The New Yorker. Now, he forgave them, and he said, he actually wrote a few years later the following words. He wrote, I operated generally on too high a level for routine reporting and had not at that time discovered the eloquence of facts. I can see why the Times fired me. A youth who persisted in rising above facts must have been a headache to a city editor. So, Paul, you want to... Paul's finishing up with Marianne. But
yeah.
We're going to now read The Passing of Alpheus W. Halliday.
Thank you, Gene. The Passing of Alpheus W. Halliday. A December Tale by E.B. White. Old Mr. Halliday, year upon year, showed small zest for the season of cheer. At Santa's name, at Holly's mention, he sank in coils of apprehension. A selfish man in his way of living, he had no talent for gifts and giving. The Yule with its jumble of thistles and figs was a lonely time in his bachelor digs. Shopping for mistletoe, tinsel, and tree, Alpheus Halliday still could foresee sitting in solitude, feet by the fire, opening things he didn't desire. He determines to correct this and give himself a walloping present. One grim noon, on his way to Saks, Halliday halted, wheel in his tracks, returned to the office, went up in the lift, and ordered Miss Forbush, wrapped as a gift. Little Miss Forbush, out of accounting, wrapped and sent, with his spirits mounting, sweet little Forbush, tidy and teeming, wreathed in the light of an old man's dreaming. She is delivered to his home by unital knighted parcel and put under the Christmas tree. When Halliday wakened on Christmas morn, he felt at peace as though reborn. The window is frosted, the gray clouds drifting, a heavenly light in the soft snow sifting. He shaved and dressed and descended the stair to see if old Santa had really been there. Joyous and eager, he knelt at the tree, untied the red ribbon, and set his gift free. He smoothed Miss Forbush and straightened her hair, then settled himself in his favorite chair. Breathless with happiness, Halliday saw that his gift to himself was a gift without flaw. And though it was patently fraught with symbols, it wasn't a thing you could buy at Gimbel's. She was something, all right. Neither of them moved a muscle. The room had a clarity, cool and nice, as though the two figures were sculptured in ice. I wish I had a photograph of it. All the long morning in grateful surmise, Alpheus Halliday studied his prize. He seemed to be tracing in Forbush's trance patterns of loveliness, strains of the dance. He seemed to be dreaming and tending the fires of old, and I trust, imprecise desires. He seemed to be seeking to capture again certain lost fragrances, woods after rain. Miss Forbush very sensibly turns into barley sugar. At noon, ere either one had stirred, a timely miracle occurred. In silence and with gentle grace, she shed her mortal carapace. Her form, her face, her eyes, her hair were barley sugar now for fair. And though it seemed to you incredible, Miss Forbush, well, was fully edible. Halliday is well known for his sweet tooth. Stiffly but hungrily, Halliday rose, picked up Miss Forbush, and sampled her toes. Here was the answer to all his vague wishes. Little Miss Forbush was simply delicious. Anxious to linger, yet hot to devour, he ate his way onward hour after hour. The window was frosted, the gray clouds drifting, a heavenly light in the snow, soft snow sifting, just as he finished her brow and her hair. Old Mr. Halliday died in his chair. Too much free sugar and time that's been spended, Halliday's life was most tranquilly ended. Perfect his passing, as sweet as his tooth, he died from an overindulgence in youth. Let us not judge him too harshly in the season of mercy and forgiveness. That's it.
Thank you, Paul. Now remind me to lower this microphone because Marianne is going to come and read this next story, and she's a little shorter than I am. Alan Gerganis, who wrote The Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All, crafted this story, which is part of his collection of short stories called White People. And we're so pleased and privileged to have Marianne Owen, one of Seattle's great theatrical treasures, to read it for us. So, Marianne?
It Had Wings by Alan Gerganis. Find a little yellow side street house. Put an older woman in it. Dress her in a tatty favorite robe. Pull her slippers up before the sink. And have her doing dishes, gazing nowhere, at her own backyard, gazing everywhere. Something falls outside, loud. One damp thwunk into new grass. A meteor? She herself retired from selling formal clothes at Wanamaker's. She herself, a widow and the mother of three scattered sons, she herself, alone at home a lot these days, goes on to tiptoe, leans across a sink full of suds, sees, out near her picnic table, something nude, white, overly long. It keeps shivering. Both wings seem damaged. No way, she says. It appears human. Yes, it is a male one. It's face up, and you can tell it is extremely male. Uncircumcised. This old woman, pushing 80, a history of aches, uses, fun, now presses one damp hand across her eyes. Blaming strain, the luster of new cataracts, she looks again. Still, it rests there on a bright air mattress of its own wings. Outer feathers are tough quills, broad at bottom as rowboat oars. The whole left wing bends far under. It looks hurt. The widow, sighing, takes up her blue willow mug of heated milk. Shaking her head, muttering, she carries it out back. She moves so slow because arthritis. It criticizes every step. It asks about the mug she holds. Do you really need this? She stoops, creaky, beside what can only be a young angel, unconscious. Quick, she checks overhead. Ready for what? Some TV news crew in a helicopter? She sees only the sky of the usual size, a Tuesday sky stretched between weekends. She allows herself to touch this thing's white forehead. She gets a mild electric shock. Then, odd, her tickled finger joints stop aching. They've hurt so long. A practical person, she quickly cures the other hand. The angel grunts, but sounds pleased. His temperature is 150, easy. But for him, this seems somehow normal. Poor thing, she says, and careful, pulls his heavy, curly head into her lap. The head hums like a phone knocked off its cradle. She scans for neighbors, hoping they'll come out, wishing they wouldn't. Both. Look, will warm milk help? She pours some down him. A wrist brushes angel skin, which pulls the way an ice tray begs whatever touches it. A 30-year pain leaves her, enters him. Even her liver spots are lightening. He grunts with pleasure, soaking up all of it. Bold, she presses her worst hip deep into crackling feathers. That hip has been half numb since a silly fall last February. All stiffness leaves her. He goes, ugh. Her griefs seem to fatten him like vitamins. Bolder, she whispers private woes. The Medicare cuts. The sons, too casual by half. The daughters-in-law, not bad, but not so great. These woes seem ended. Nobody'll believe. Still, tell me some of it. She tilts nearer. Both his eyes stay shut, but his voice, like clicks from a million crickets pooled, goes, where'd just another army. We all look alike. We didn't before. It's not what you expect. We missed the other. Don't count on the next. Notice things here. We're just another army. Oh, she says. Nodding, she feels limber now, sure as any girl of 20. Admiring her unspeckled hands, she helps him rise. Wings serve as handles. Kneeling on there, wobbly, standing. He is handsome, but as a vase is handsome. When he turns this way, she sees his eyes. They're silver. Each reflects her. A speck, pink, on green, green grass. She now fears he plans to take her up as thanks. She presses both palms flat to dirt, says, the house is finally paid off. Not just yet, and smiles. Suddenly, he's infinitely, infinitely more so, silvery, raw, gleaming like a sunny monument, a clock. Each wing puffs, independent. Feathers sort and shuffle like 300 packs of playing cards. Outflings either arm. Knees dip low, then up and off he shoves. One solemn grunt. Machete swipes across her backyard. Breezes cool her upturned face. 6 feet overhead, he falters. Whips in makeshift circles. Manages to hold aloft, then go shrub high, gutter high. He avoids a messy tangle of phone lines now rocking from the wind of him. Go! Go! The widow, grinning, points the way. Do! Yeah! Good! He signals back at her. Opened mouth and left down there. First, a glinting man-sized kite. Next, an oblong of aluminum in sun. Now, a new moon shrunk to decent star. One fleck. Fleck's memory. Usual Tuesday sky. She kneels, panting, happier and frisky. She's hungry, but first must rush over and tell Lydia next door. Then she pictures Lydia's worry lines bunching. Lydia will maybe phone the missing sons. Come right home, your mom's inventing company. Maybe other angels have dropped into other Elm Street backyards. Behind fences, did neighbors help earlier hurt ones? Folks keep so much of the best stuff quiet, don't they? Palms on knees, she stands, wirier. This retired saleswoman was the formal gowns advisor to 10 mayor's wives. She spent 60 years of 9 to 5 on her feet. Scuffing indoors, now staring down at Terry's slippers, she decides, got to wash these next week. Can a person who's just sighted her first angel already be mulling about laundry? Yes, the world is like that. From her sink, she sees her own blue willow mug out there in the grass. It rests in muddy ruts where the falling body struck so hard. A neighbor's collie keeps barking. It saw. Okay. This happened. So, she says, and plunges hands into dishwater, still warm. He usually helps her achy joints feel agile, but fingers don't even hurt now. Her bad hip doesn't pinch one bit, and yet, sad, they will. By supper time, they will again remind her what usual suffering means. To her nimble underwater hands, the widow, staring straight ahead, announces, I helped. He flew off stronger. I really egged him on. Like anybody would have, really. Still, it was me. I'm not just somebody in a house. I'm not just somebody alone in a house. I'm not just somebody else alone in a house. Feeling more herself, she finishes the breakfast dishes in time for lunch. This old woman should be famous for all she's been through. today's angel, her years and sales, the sons and friends. She should be famous for her life. She knows things. She's seen so much. She's not famous. Still, the lady keeps gazing past her kitchen cafe curtains. She keeps studying her own backyard. An anchor fence, the picnic table, barbecue pit, new Bermuda grass. Hands braced on sink's cool edge, she tips nearer a bright window. She seems to be expecting something. Expecting something decent. Her kitchen clock is ticking. The dog still barks to calm itself. And she keeps staring out. Nowhere. Everywhere. Spots on hands are darkening again. And yet she whispers, I'm right here. Ready. Ready for more. Can you guess why this old woman's chin is lifted? Why does she breathe as if to show exactly how it's done? Why should both her shoulders, usually quite bent, brace so square just now? She's guarding the world. Only nobody knows.
Something more.
Well, so there's a little story behind Pineola. Leslie Brawley writes all of these songs that you're going to hear tonight. And these particular songs, I've been giving her the stories and poems that we're going to read in August of, you know, late summer. And she goes away, reads them, and then crafts an individual response to each one of them. And I'm such a fan of what she and John and Josh and your new drummer's name is
Dirk
are doing. Anyway, so our next story is by Ken Kesey, and who was born in La Junta, Colorado, the son of dairy farmers, Geneva and Frederick Kesey, and he moved to Springfield, Oregon when he was about 11 years old, and grew up, you know, was really, I'd say, reached puberty and was raised in Oregon. And Kesey said of himself that given his age, I think he was born in 35, given his age, he was too young to be a beatnik and too old to be a hippie. So he became a merry prankster. He wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Sometimes a Great Notion, both of which were made into kind of extraordinary films. And also wrote the following memoir in The New Yorker, read today by, is Randy Hoffmeyer here? Is he anywhere around? Oh, here he comes, straight from Randy. You just arrived from the Water Wheel Tavern, right. I think. Okay.
Okay. Well, at the finale of the Christmas show last year in Eugene, Oregon, I came out as a Skid Row Santa, complete with rubber nose, a plastic sack full of beer cans, and some peppermint schnapps to fortify the holiday spirit. So I also borrowed my wife Faye's blue egg bucket, and I labeled it homeless. And I jangled the cans like a bag full of aluminum sleigh bells, and I worked the main floor aisle seats. You know, like, hey, come on, buddy, put something in the bucket, for Christ's sakes, don't you know it's Christmas time? Hey, that's better. Yeah, God bless you. You're beautiful. Well, I ended up with only about $75. Not much of a take for a full house at a Christmas show. But even $75 was a wad too big to pocket. So I got out of my red suit and rubber snoot, and I drove off to seek a worthy recipient. Well, I spotted a likely assortment of candidates at the 7-Eleven parking lot on the corner of 6th and Blair. I swung in, and I held my bucket up out the window, and I said, all right, who's the hardest luck case here, huh? Well, the candidates all looked me over and edged away. All but one guy, ponytailed and slope-shouldered, you know, his chin tucked down in the collar of a canvas camouflage jacket. I got a streak of hard luck runs all the way back to New Jersey, he says. What about it? Well, I'm on a mission from St. Nicholas, I say. And if you are, in fact, the least fortunate of the... Oh, in the spirit of the season, I didn't say biggest loser. The least fortunate of the lot, then this could be your lucky night. Oh, right, he says. What, you some kind of holy roller, huh? Where's the string, huh? What's the hustle? I said, hey, no string, no catch, no hustle. I'm giving, you're getting. Get it? Well, he did. He took the money and ran, taking Faye's egg bucket in the bargain. And the last I saw him, he was scurrying away, looking for a hole somewhere. You know, since then, I've wondered about him. You know, did that little windfall make a difference? Did he rent a cheap room? Did he get a bath? Did he find a companion? And every time I found myself passing through one of Eugene's hard luck harbors, I kept half an eye peeled for the sight of a long tail of black hair draggling down the back of a camouflage jacket. Well, last week, a year ago to the day, I made a sighting. I was in town with Faye and our daughter getting in some Christmas shopping before we rendezvoused with my mom for supper. Well, we had done a couple of hours in the mall, and I was shopped out. I announced that I wanted to make some private purchases, and I slipped out into the rainy cold alone. I was headed for the liquor store on 8th, thinking the spirit could use a little fortification. Well, the trusty peppermint wasn't powerful enough. These hometown streets are just too strange, too vacant, too sad. Well, the corner of 6th and Olive, empty. Oh, the great Dairy Gold Creamery that my dad built up from a little Eugene Farmers Cooperative, bulldozed down. I ducked my head, kept walking in the rain. The street in my memory was the clearer path anyway. Oh, John Warren's Hardware, right over there, where you could buy blasting powder across the counter. The Corral Novelty Shop, where you could buy itching powder. Oh, the Heilig Theater, with its all the way across the street arch, flashing what we all took to be Norwegian for hello. So it could be read all the way down from the windows in the train. Heilig, heilig, heilig. All gone. The street is too sad. But when I reached the city center, I noticed that the thing that people had finally given up trying to call a fountain was newly disguised with pine boughs and potted plants. No avail, huh? I still looked like the remnants of a bombed-out French cathedral. Then, when the rain eased up, I was surprised to discover that the ruins were not quite deserted. I saw a loose black braid hanging down the back of a camouflage jacket. That seemed right. He was in the old fountain's basin, you know, bent in a concealing position. A one in the potted pines. I came up from behind him and I clapped my hand on his shoulder. Hey, what you doing, hard luck? Coming counting another bucket of money, huh? He wheeled around and had my wrist clamped in a bone-breaking grasp before I could finish the word. Then I saw that this wasn't a chinless street rat standing down in the basin after all. This was a block-jawed American Indian built like two fireplugs sitting in a wheelchair. Oh, ouch, man, let go. I thought you were somebody else. Well, he eased the hold but kept the wrist. I told him about last year's long hair and matching jacket. He listened, studying my eyes. Okay, sorry about the twist. I was taking a leak. You surprised me. Hey, let's get out of the rain. See what kind of medicine you got sticking out of your pocket. We retired under some scaffolding. He was less than enthusiastic about my choice of pocket medicine. I'd rather drink something like Southern Comfort if I have to choose a sugar drink, he said, but we passed the pint back and forth. Watched the rain. He leaned to spit, and a folded army blanket slipped out of his lap. His legs were as gone as the main gut of my poor hometown. He was a part-time fillet man from a Pike Place market up in Seattle, on his way to spend Christmas with his family on the res outside of Albuquerque. His bus was laid up for a couple of hours.
I think they're getting the Greyhound spayed before she gets to California.
When the pint was about three quarters gone, I screwed the lid on and held it out. Hey, I gotta meet the women. Go ahead, keep it.
I guess not, he said.
Well, you're pretty choosy for a thirsty man, aren't you? Well, what would be your best druthers?
To have the money and make my own choice.
I reached for my wallet. Well, I think I got a couple of bucks.
And a quarter? If I had $2 and a quarter, I could get a pint of 10 high.
With 4 and change, I'd go on to Fair to Midland Fifth, cream of Kentucky.
I hesitated.
Was I being hustled? Okay, let's see what I got. I emptied the wallet and the pockets onto his blanket. He added a few coins and counted the collection.
$9.75. If I come up with another $2, I can get a bottle of Bushmills Irish. Think I can panhandle $2 between here and the liquor store? Oh, without a doubt, I said, with both panhandles tied behind your back. We shook hands goodbye and headed off in our separate directions, strolling and rolling through the rain.
At the restaurant, my mother wanted to know what I was thinking about that gave me such a goofy grin. Well, I was just thinking, if beggars can't be choosers, then it must follow that choosers, by definition, can't be beggars. Well, this year for the Christmas show, Santa's got himself a classier outfit and wrangled some holiday helpers out of the high school choir. God bless them. We're going to work all the aisles. Come on out, you helpers. Come on out here. Get down there and panhandle. Hey, you guys in the audience, start passing your money to the aisles there. This ain't no time to nickel and dime. For Christ's sakes, it's Christmas time. Oh, oh.
Let's take a short intermission.
Why do I hurt myself? How do I lose my own way? I'm just a little lamb dressed up in a wolf's clothing. I'll set trickery, cast a long shadow on my heart, and then sweetly, swiftly, surely the spirit moves in the dark. Searching for what is mine, I turn over every stone, I scale such great heights and fall so hard, so alone, each new beginning I somehow damage from the start. But then sweetly, swiftly, surely the spirit moves in the dark. It's tenderly lifted back up every nail in my coffin. Who's just as solid as a tack? For sweetly, swiftly, surely the spirit moves in the dark. Oh, sweetly, swiftly, surely the spirit moves in the dark.
So thanks to Pineola, which is Leslie Braley, who wrote all these songs. John Owen, who's kind of their arranger and creator of sound. And we have Josh Woods and on bass, and Dirk Lebsack on drums. So Clement Clark Moore's Night Before Christmas has been delivered in more versions than any of us can. We'd have to sit through years of performances to get through even half of them. And it's been called the most famous verses ever written by an American. Written in 1823, this poem has given us a portrait of St. Nicholas, which has held sway to this day, but it begs the question, why has this rogue not been arrested and convicted for his multiple house invasions? And this afternoon, our special guest, noted jurist, professor of law at Seattle University, David Scover, will put paid once and for all to such a conviction and deliver for us a judicial decision. David?
Silence. I here render the judicial opinion and judgment in the case of State versus Clause, colloquially known as the Night Before Christmas. Whereas
On or about the night prior to Christmas, there did occur at a certain improved piece of real property, hereinafter the house, a general lack of stirring by all creatures, including but not limited to a mouse, a variety of foot apparel, exempli grazie, that is, for example, stockings, socks, etc., etc., had been affixed by and around the chimney of said house in the hope and or belief that Saint Nick, also known as Saint Nicholas, also known as Santa Claus, hereinafter Claus, would arrive at some time thereafter. The minor residence, id est, that is, of the aforementioned house were located in their individual beds and were engaged in nocturnal hallucinations, that is, dreams, wherein visions of confectionery treats, including, but not limited to, candies, nuts, and or sugar plums, did dance, cavort, and otherwise appear in such dreams. Whereupon the party of the first part, hereinafter referred to as I, being the joint owner in fee simple of the house with the party of the second part, hereinafter Mama, I and said Mama had retired for a sustained period of sleep. At such time, the parties were clad in various forms of headgear. For example, kerchief and cap. Suddenly, and without prior notice or warning, there did occur on an unimproved piece of property adjacent and appurtenant to said house, that is, the lawn, a certain disruption of unknown nature, cause, and or circumstance, the party of the first part did immediately rush to a window in the house to investigate the cause of such disturbance. At that time, the party of the first part did observe with some degree of wonder and or disbelief a miniature sleigh, hereinafter the vehicle, being pulled and or drawn very rapidly through the air by approximately 8 reindeer. The driver of the vehicle appeared to be, and in fact was, the previously referenced Claus. Said Claus was providing specific direction, instruction, and guidance to the approximately 8 reindeer, and specifically identified the animal co-conspirators by name: Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid, Donner, Blitzen. Hereinafter, the deer. Upon information and belief, it is further asserted that an additional co-conspirator named Rudolph may have been involved. The party of the first part witnessed Claus, the vehicle, and the deer intentionally and willfully trespass upon the roofs of several residences located adjacent to and in the vicinity of the house, and noted that the vehicle was heavily laden with packages, toys, and other items of unknown origin and nature. Suddenly, and without prior invitation or permission, either express or implied, the vehicle arrived at the house and Claus entered the house via the chimney. Said Claus was clad in a red fur suit which was partially covered with residue from the chimney, and he carried a large sack containing a portion of the aforementioned packages, toys, and other unknown items. He was smoking what appeared to be tobacco in a small pipe in blatant violation of local ordinances and health regulations. Claus did not speak, but immediately began to fill the stockings of the minor children, which hung adjacent to the chimney, with toys and small gifts. Said items did not, however, constitute gifts to said minors pursuant to the applicable tax codes. Upon completion of such tasks, Claus touched the side of his nose and flew, rose, and or ascended up the chimney of the house to the roof where the vehicle and deer waited and or served as lookouts. Claus immediately departed for an unknown destination. However, prior to the departure of the vehicle, deer and Claus from such house, the party of the first part did hear Claus state and or exclaim, "Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night," or words to such effect. It is the judgment of this court that Claus, being of goodwill in this season of charity and benevolence, is not guilty. The charge of malicious breaking and entering is hereby dismissed.
Well, that's a relief. So we're going to do a quick trip to France for just a few minutes. There's a story written by Prix Goncourt winner Michel Tournier, also a member of the Academy Goncourt, who he elucidates for us a division in France, which I think is between the secular and the religious. And whenever I've been in Paris, I stay with a friend in the 5th arrondissement, and right across the street from our house is an old church which was taken over by some very conservative Catholics and the priests and their students. And it's only a few blocks from the Sorbonne. So whenever the students parade at the end of the term, the priests come out, the young priests come out and throw fruits at them and vegetables, and the students respond in kind. So Michel Tournier writes about this division in a small village between the secular and the religious. It's called Mother Christmas. Would the village of Poudrezac enjoy a time of peace? For years, it had been torn apart by conflict, supporters of the clergy against the radicals, the denominational school run by the brothers against the local state school, the parish priest against the schoolmaster. The hostilities, which changed colors with the seasons, took on a legendary brilliance as the year-end festivities arrived. For practical reasons, midnight mass took place on December 24th at 6 in the evening. At the same time, the schoolmaster, dressed up as Father Christmas, would give out toys to the pupils at the state school. Under his ministrations, Father Christmas became a pagan, radical, anti-clerical hero against whom the parish priest would brandish the baby Jesus in his living nativity scene, renowned throughout the canton, just as one throws holy water in the devil's face. Would a truce indeed come to Poudrezac? You see, the schoolmaster had retired and had been replaced by a schoolmistress who was new to the area. Everyone was watching her to see which side she was on. Madame Wazeline, a mother of two, including a three-month-old baby, was divorced, which seemed to be proof of her secular credentials. But the clergy's supporters immediately won out on the first Sunday as the new schoolmistress made a conspicuous appearance at church. It seemed that the die had been cast. There would no longer be a sacrilegious Christmas tree during midnight mass, and the parish priest would retain sole control over the land. Everyone was greatly surprised when Madame Wazeline announced to her charges that there would be no change to the tradition and that Father Christmas would give out his gifts at the usual time. What was she up to? And who would play the role of Father Christmas? The postman and the village constable, who came to everybody's mind due to their socialist leanings, maintained that they were unaware of any plan. When it was learned that Madame Wazeline would be lending her baby to the parish priest to play the baby Jesus in his living nativity scene, the villagers' astonishment reached its peak. In the beginning, all went well. The little Wazeline child slept soundly as the faithful filed by the nativity scene, their eyes sharp with curiosity. The ox and donkey, a live ox and a live donkey, seemed moved by this secular baby who had been so miraculously transformed into the Savior. Unfortunately, the baby started fussing as the gospel reading began, and his screams exploded just as the priest ascended the pulpit. No one had ever heard a baby's voice that loud. In vain, the young girl playing the Virgin Mary rocked him against her meager bosom. Scarlet with anger, swaying his feet and waving his arms, the little brat made the church's vaulted ceiling ring with his furious cries. The priest could not get a word in edgewise. Finally, he called one of his choir boys and whispered an order in his ear. Without removing his surplice, the young boy left, the sound of his clogs fading away in the distance. A few minutes later, the clericalist half of the village, all gathered together in the nave, saw an incredible sight that would go down in legend in the region of Pont-l'Abbé. Father Christmas himself broke into the church and rushed up to the manger. Then he pushed aside his big white cotton wool beard, unbuttoned his red wool jacket, and offered a generous breast to the suddenly calm baby Jesus.
Thank you.
I say yes. There's no denying this. And still you keep me guessing. What used to be so clear after all these years. I don't know what's coming when you call my name. I'll drop everything and I will come running. It's better every time. I fall back in line, knowing one day you will be mine. These lines across my face grow deeper every day, and I'm still waiting for you. This voice inside my head tells me you're the one. Tells me one day it will be my turn. When you call my name, I'll drive everything and I will come running. It's better every time, so I fall back in line. Been dreaming all these years, or have I too much doubt, baby? When you call my name, I'll drop everything and I will come running. It's better every time, so I fall back in line.
So we come to our last story of the evening. Evening? Not yet. It's by Vladimir Nabokov, who is kind of an extraordinary character. He was fluent in Russian, English, and French, and was that marvel of writers, able to communicate in all three languages and wrote fluently in two of them. He was also a passionate lepidopterist and spent much of his life searching for a new species of butterflies, and in fact had an entire genus named after him, genus Nabokovia. Like Chekhov, who said that medicine was his wife and literature his mistress, when he got tired of one, he spent the night with the other. Nabokov once commented, "The pleasures and rewards of literary inspiration are nothing besides the rapture of discovering a new organ under the microscope of an undescribed species on a mountainside in Iran or Peru." And now Marianne is going to read us a story in which a butterfly collector stumbles his way from a seemingly unfathomable darkness towards a faint glimmer of light. Marianne.
He's way taller. Christmas by Vladimir Nabokov. After walking back from the village to his manor across dimming shadows, Sleptsov sat down in a corner on a plush-covered chair which he had never remembered using before. It was the kind of thing that happens after some great calamity. Not your brother, but a chance acquaintance, a vague country neighbor to whom in normal times you exchange scarcely a word, is the one who comforts you wisely and gently and hands you your dropped hat after the funeral service is over and you're reeling from grief, your teeth chattering, your eyes blinded by tears. The same can be said of inanimate objects. Any room, even the coziest and most absurdly small, in the little used wing of a great country house has an unlived-in corner. And it was such a corner in which Sleptsov sat. The wing was connected by a wooden gallery, now encumbered with our huge North Russian snowdrifts, to the master house, used only in summer. There was no need to awaken it, to heat it. The master had come from Petersburg for only a couple of days and had settled in the annex, where it was a simple matter to get the stoves a white Dutch tile going. The master sat in his corner, on that plush chair, as in a doctor's waiting room. The room floated in darkness. The dense blue of early evening filtered through the crystal feathers of frost on the windowpane. Ivan, the quiet, portly valet who had recently shaved off his mustache and now looked like his late father, the family butler, brought in a kerosene lamp, all trimmed and brimming with light. He set it on a small table and noiselessly caged it with its pink silk shade. For an instant, a tilted mirror reflected his lit ear and cropped gray hair. Then he withdrew and the door gave a subdued creak. Sleptsov raised his hand from his knee and slowly examined it. A drop of candle wax had stuck and hardened in the thin fold of skin between two fingers. He spread his fingers and the little white scale cracked. The following morning, after a night spent in nonsensical, fragmentary dreams totally unrelated to his grief, as Sleptsov stepped out into the cold veranda, a floorboard emitted a merry pistol crack underfoot, and the reflections of the many-colored panes formed paradisal lozenges on the whitewashed, cushionless window seats. The outer door resisted at first, then opened with a luscious crunch, and the dazzling frost hit his face. The reddish sand, providently sprinkled on the ice coating the porch steps, resembled cinnamon, and the thick icicles shot with greenish-blue hung from the eaves. The snowdrifts reached all the way to the windows of the annex, tightly gripping the snug little wooden structure in their frosty clutches. The creamy white mounds of what were flower beds in summer swelled slightly above the level snow in front of the porch, and farther off loomed the radiance of the park, where every black branchlet was rimmed in silver, and the firs seemed to draw in their green paws under their bright, plump load. Wearing high felt boots and a short, fur-lined coat with a caracal collar, Sleptsov strode off slowly along a straight path, the only one cleared of snow, into that blinding, distant landscape. He was amazed to be still alive and able to perceive the brilliance of the snow and feel his front teeth ache from the cold. He even noticed that a snow-covered bush resembled a fountain, and that a dog had left a series of saffron marks on the slope of a snowdrift, which had burnt through its crust. A little further, the supports of a footbridge stuck out of the snow, And there Slepsoff stopped. Bitterly, angrily, he pushed the thick, fluffy covering off the parapet. He vividly recalled how this bridge looked in summer. There was his son walking along the slippery planks, flecked with aments, and deftly plucking off with his net a butterfly that had settled on a railing. Now the boy sees his father. Forever lost, laughter plays on his face under the turned-down brim of a straw hat burned dark by the sun. His hand toys the chainlet of a leather purse attached to his belt. His dear, smooth, suntanned legs in their serge shorts and soaked sandals assume their usual, cheerful, widespread stance. Just recently in Petersburg, after having babbled in his delirium about school, about his bicycle, about some great oriental moth, he died. And yesterday, Slepsoff had taken the coffin, weighed down, it seems, with an entire lifetime, to the country, into the family vault near the village church. It was quiet as it only can be on a bright, frosty day. Slepsoff raised his leg high, stepped off the path, and, leaving blue pits behind him in the snow, made his way among the trunks of amazingly white trees to the spot where the park dropped off toward the river. Far below, ice blocks sparkled near a hole cut in the smooth expanse of white, and on the opposite bank, very straight columns of pink smoke stood above the snowy roofs of log cabins. Slepsoff took off his caracal cap and leaned against a tree trunk. Somewhere far away, peasants were chopping wood. Every blow bounced resonantly skyward. And beyond the light silver mist of trees, high above the squat isbus, the sun caught the equanimous radiance of the cross on the church. That was where he was headed after lunch, in an old sleigh with a high straight back. The cod of the black stallion clacked strongly in the frosty air. The white plumes of low branches glided overhead, and the ruts in the front gave off a silvery blue sheen. When he arrived, he sat for an hour or so by the grave, resting a heavy, woolen-gloved hand on the iron of the railing that burnt his hand through the wool. He came home with a slight sense of disappointment, as if there, in the burial vault, he had been even further removed from his son than here, where the countless summer tracks of his rapid sandals were preserved beneath the snow. In the evening, overcome by a fit of intense sadness, he had the main house unlocked. When the door swung open with a weighty wail and a whiff of special, unwintry coolness came from the sonorous iron barn vestibule, Slepsoff took off the lamp with its tin reflector from the washman's hand and entered the house alone. The parquet floors crackled eerily under his step. Room after room filled with yellow light, and the shrouded furniture seemed unfamiliar. Instead of a tinkling chandelier, a soundless bag hung from the ceiling. And Slepsoff's enormous shadow, slowly extending one hand, floated across the wall and over the gray squares of curtain paintings. He went into the room which had been his son's study in summer, set the lamp on the window ledge, and, breaking his fingernails as he did so, opened the folding shutters, even though all was darkness outside. In the blue glass, the yellow flame of the slightly smoky lamp appeared, and his large bearded face showed momentarily. He sat down at the bare desk and sternly, from under his bent brows, examined the pale wallpaper with its garlands of bluish roses, the narrow office-like cabinet with sliding drawers from top to bottom, the couch and armchairs under slipcovers, and suddenly, dropping his head onto the desk, He started to shake passionately, noisily, pressing first his lips, then his wet cheek to the cold, dusty wood and clutching at its far corners. In the desk, he found a notebook, spreading board, supplies of black pins, and an English biscuit tin that contained a large, exotic cocoon, which had cost 3 rubles. It was papery to the touch and seemed made of a brown, folded leaf. His son had remembered it during his sickness, regretting that he had left it behind, but consoling himself with the thought that the chrysalid inside was probably dead. He also found a torn net, a tarlatan bag on a collapsible hoop, and the muslin still smelled of summer and sun-hot grass. Then, bending lower and lower and sobbing with his whole body, he began pulling out, one by one, the glass-topped drawers of the cabinet. In the dim lamplight, the even files of specimens shone silk-like under the glass. Here, in this room, on this very desk, his son had spread the wings of his captures. He would first pin the carefully killed insect in the cork-bottom groove of the setting board between adjustable strips of wood, and fastened down flat with pinned strips of paper the still fresh, soft wings. They had now dried long ago and been transferred to the cabinet. Those spectacular swallowtails, those dazzling coppers and blues, and the various fritillaries, some mounted in supine position to display the mother-of-pearl undersides. His son used to pronounce their Latin names with a moan of triumph, or in an arch aside of disdain. And the moths, the moths! The first aspen hawk of 5 summers ago. The night was smoke blue and moonlit. Thin clouds were scattered about the sky but did not touch the delicate icy moon. The trees, masses of gray frost, cast dark shadows on the drifts, which scintillated here and there with metallic sparks. In the plush-upholstered, well-heated room of the annex, Ivan had placed a 2-foot fir tree in a clay pot on the table and was just attaching a candle to its cruciform tip when Slepsov returned from the main house, chilled, red-eyed, with gray dust smears on his cheek, carrying a wooden case under his arm. Seeing the Christmas tree on the table, he asked absently, "What's that?" Relieving him of the case, Ivan assured him, he answered him in a low, mellow voice, "There's a holiday coming up tomorrow." "No, take it away," said Slepsov with a frown, while thinking, "Can this be Christmas Eve? How could I have forgotten?" Ivan gently insisted, "It's nice and green. Let it stand for a while." "Please, take it away," repeated Slepsov, and bent over the case he had brought. In it, he had gathered his son's belongings, the folding butterfly net, the biscuit tin with the pear-shaped cocoon, the spreading board, the pins in their lacquered box, the blue notebook. Half of the first page had been torn out, and its remaining fragment contained part of a French dictation. There followed daily entries, names of captured butterflies, and other notes. "Walked across the bog as far as Borovichi. Raining today. Played checkers with father. Then read Goncharov's Frigate. A deadly bore. Marvelous hot day. Rode my bike in the evening. A midge got in my eye. Deliberately rode by her dacha twice, but didn't see her." Slepsov raised his head, swallowed something hot and huge. Of whom was his son writing? "Rode my bike as usual," he read on. "Our eyes nearly met. My darling, my love. This is unthinkable, whispered Slepsov. I'll never know. He bent over again, avidly deciphering the childish handwriting that slanted up and then curved down in the margin. Saw a fresh specimen of the Camberwell beauty today. That means autumn is here. Rain in the evening. She is probably left. And we didn't even get acquainted. Farewell, my darling. I feel terribly sad. He never said anything to me. Slepsov tried to remember, rubbing his forehead with his palm. On the last page, there was an ink drawing. The hind view of an elephant. Two thick pillars. The corners of two ears. A tiny tail. Slepsov got up. He shook his head, restraining yet another onrush of hideous sobs. I can't bear it any longer. He drawled between groans, repeating even more slowly, I can't bear it any longer. It's Christmas tomorrow, came the abrupt reminder. And I'm going to die. Of course, it's so simple. This very night. He pulled out a handkerchief and dried his eyes, his beard, his cheeks. Dark streaks remained on the handkerchief. Death, Slepsov said slowly, as if concluding a long sentence. The clock ticked. Frost patterns overlapped on the blue glass of the window. The open notebook shone radiantly on the table. Next to it, the light went through the muslin of the butterfly net and glistened on the corner of the open tin. Slepsov pressed his eyes shut and had a fleeting sensation that earthly life lay before him, totally bared and comprehensible and ghastly in its sadness, humiliatingly pointless, sterile, devoid of miracles. At that instant, there was a sudden snap, a thin sound, like that of an overstretched rubber band breaking. Slepsov opened his eyes. The cocoon in the biscuit tin had burst at its tip, and a black, wrinkled creature the size of a mouse was crawling up the wall above the table. It stopped, holding onto the surface with six black, furry feet, and started palpitating, strangely. It had emerged from the chrysalid because a man, overcome with grief, had transferred a tin box to his warm room. And the warmth that penetrated its top, leaf, and silk envelope, it had awaited this moment so long, had collected its strength so tensely, and now, having broken out, it was slowly and miraculously expanding. Gradually, the wrinkled tissues, the velvety fringes unfurled. The fan-pleated veins grew firmer as they filled with air. It became a winged thing imperceptibly, as a maturing face imperceptibly becomes beautiful. And its wings, still feeble, still moist, kept growing and unfolding, and now they were developed to the limit set for them by God. And there, on the wall, instead of a little lump of life, instead of a dark mouse, was a great Atticus moth, like those that fly, bird-like, around lamps in the Indian dusk. And then those thick black wings, with a glazy eye spot on each and a purplish bloom dusting their hooked foretips, took a full breath under the impulse of tender, ravishing, almost human happiness.
I'm going to go off script here, Gene. Look out. Leslie needs to tune her guitar, so it gives me an excuse to hog the microphone for a minute. It just so happens that one of my favorite singers, Dawn Sears, left us on Thursday. She was one of those performers that could transport a whole room and make everybody in it feel like she was singing to them. And if you want to give a listen to what she, her art, go to YouTube and look for the Time Jumpers. And she did a song called Sweet Memories, which you'll see what I'm talking about instantly, I think. But this song's called Remember Me, and it's for Dawn.
Thank you, Pineola. Thank you, Marianne Owen, and Randy Hoffmeyer, and David Scover, and Paul Dorpat. And from me, Gene Sherrard, good night. Have a wonderful, wonderful holiday season. Good night. Thank you.
Angel. within the barn door's perfect frame, and the footlights glow. The oxen on the apron knelt, and the cattle low.
Good night.
That's it for this Christmas night episode of Speakers Forum, featuring A Rogue's Christmas. This event was presented on December 14th, 2014 by Town Hall Seattle as part of the Arts and Culture Series and by Short Stories Live. Sponsors included City Arts and the Thurston Charitable Foundation. Our faithful rogues included Paul Dorpat, Gene Sherrod, Randy Hoffmeyer, Marianne Owen, David Scovar, and Seattle indie Americana band Pineola. Thanks again to Jenny Cecil Moore for this recording. From everyone here at KUOW and Speakers Forum, best wishes for happy holidays and a healthy and prosperous 2015. From KUOW, I'm John O'Brien. Good night.